This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Thomas Norris on the 2nd of October, the year 2001, at approximately 2:12. We are in the Southwest Collections Library's interview room in Lubbock, Texas. I am accompanied by John Bernstein, graduate research assistant, and Jenny Board, a graduate student in the history department. And we're also accompanied by Linda Norris, Mr. Norris's wife. Sir, why don't we begin with a brief discussion of your early life, and if you would, tell us when, where you were born, and where you grew up.
Okay. I was born in Godfrey, Illinois, one of 14 children. Did a lot of farm labor, that type of early activity. Seems like I was always learning to work or do something with a family that size. It was back then when I was probably 4 or 5 years old that I remember first wanting to fly. Seeing airplanes flying over, I just couldn't quite stand seeing somebody else do it and not being able to do it. As I grew up and finished high school, I decided to go to college because you needed 2 years of college to get in to the cadet program, be a pilot. Mm-hmm. So it was during that time that I had my first flight in an airplane. I think I was probably 18 or 19. And that I paid for myself, cost me $5. Went through ROTC, got my 2 years in, went to the recruiter and said, I'm here, send me to pilot training. He said, I'm going to take your application, but I can't. They quit doing that. I said, well, how did I get to do it? And he said, well, you got to get a college degree. So very begrudgingly, I went back 3 more years and got a college degree. It took me that much longer. After that, well, I did start pilot training at Laredo Air Force Base and flew the T-37 and the T-33. I was going to fly helicopters, but the Vietnamese got all the helicopters, and so I went back to be an instructor in the ATC, Air Training Command. And it was during that period at Moody Air Force Base that I was there for about 3 years that I got my assignment to 105 training and to Southeast Asia. Went to Nellis Air Force Base, went through 105 training there for about 6 months. Finished that up early spring in 1967, and then went to Southeast Asia in May and started flying combat missions. At that time, we were allocated, let's say, or at least expected to get 100 missions, at which time you could return to the United States. There was no length of time that you had to be there, just 100 missions. And I was shot down on my 47th mission, so I got 46 and a half missions. I was almost half done when on August the 12th I got shot down, and I started about May the 12th. So I was shot down over Hanoi, bombing the Canal de Repetes Bridge with 3,000 pound bombs. We did knock the bridge down. I was hit by 37 or 57 millimeter anti-aircraft fire pulling off of the target. Took a direct hit on the nose cone, it blew it off. Shrapnel and pieces of airplane went through the engine. Well, the engine was still running, and I was able to make it about 20 miles to the base of what we call Thud Ridge, where I had to bail out because the airplane wouldn't climb and it wouldn't go over the next hill. And about 5 minutes later, I was captured by the villagers, and they held me for a couple hours until the Army came and got me. And the Army picked me up in a Jeep, drove me to an airfield blindfolded, put me on a helicopter, and flew me to the prison camp. So I was in the prison camp about 4 hours after I was shot down. We'll get into the details of confinement later. Mm-hmm. To release, I was released on March 14th, 1973, and came back to the United States. Went through recurrency training at Randolph Air Force Base in T-38s. I met Linda at that point. We got married sometime later. And since then, I flew T-38s in the Instrument Flight Center. Went to the T-41 program, which is a screening program in Hondo, Texas, and went to the War College in Maxwell Air Force Base. And then after that, I got out of flying, and I was in the comptroller field, where I was director of accounting and finance for Air Training Command, then Pacific Air Forces at Hawaii, and then back to Lackland Air Force Base, where I retired as a comptroller. And after getting out of the military, I worked for Braniff Airlines, TWA, and I currently fly for United Parcel Service. That brings us up to date.
Yes, sir. Okay, thank you.
Today I made a motorhome trip to Lubbock, Texas. I find myself in a room with
thank
Steve,
you.
Jenny, and John.
Thank you. A couple of questions about growing up on a farm. First of all, I would imagine that was rather hard work, and growing up with 14 other brothers and sisters. And
from a kid's point of view, it was almost an idyllic point of view. We'd take off all our clothes and run up and down the creek beds, you know, in the summertime, go out and live in the woods for 2 or 3 days and shoot squirrels out of season and do things like that. We did have to work, and the smell of fresh mown hay gives me cold chills. It doesn't smell good to me. I know what it means to be in a barn with a bunch of hay. And yeah, we did a lot of hoe work and stuff like that, but we actually lived on and off the farm. We lived in a subdivision type area, a suburb area of Alton, Illinois, back and forth. My dad never liked staying any place longer than 3 years, so he had these two places and we went back and forth. But I liked the farm the best.
Yeah.
Still do.
Was he in the service during the Second World War?
World War One. Corporal Norris.
What did he do?
He didn't do anything specific, but because he didn't go into battle. But all of my brothers, and there are six other brothers that are alive, all served in the military. My oldest brother, Joe, was a B-17 pilot in World War II. My next brother, John, landed at Normandy, fought all through Europe, Battle of the Bulge a whole bit, and was wounded once. Out of his company of 120-some, there was only three or four of them that escaped. And he was waiting to invade Japan. And they kept extending his leave and extending his leave, and then they dropped the bombs and they told him just go muster out. That was a big day for the family. I don't know if he would have survived that. My other two brothers, next brothers after that, Bob and Harold, served in the Navy. Neither of them saw service or duty. And my next brother, Paul, just older than me, was in the Army Reserve. And then my youngest brother was in the Navy, and none of them saw any service, combat service.
As you were growing up, would they discuss that service much with you?
My brother that invaded Normandy would not. Once in a while, when I was getting ready to go to Vietnam, he gave me some advice on how to survive, which kind of caught me off guard because he would never hardly ever talk about it. And we would ask him questions, and he would bypass them. As kids, kids ask dumb questions, and he would bypass those questions. But he did tell me a few stories about shooting at tiger tanks with bazookas and having the shell bounce off and running for it, that type of stuff. And the tiger tanks shooting down the hedgerows and the trees popping up, things that impressed him.
Mm-hmm.
But the other brother, the one that flew the B-17, he did not see any combat, and he's very talkative about his flying episodes.
And what was the advice that your brother...
Save your strength.
Okay.
He said, save your strength, because when you need it, it won't be there if you waste it. And he got that feeling from being on the ground as an infantryman, that when the time came to run for it or something like that, the guys didn't have enough and they fell behind and they were lost. That type of thing. Or if they needed to dash from one hole to another, they just couldn't do it fast enough. So that was his advice to me. It didn't apply to an airplane jock, but very much. But I took it to heart. So.
Did the experiences of your brothers have much of an influence on your decision to serve, or was it principally you just wanted to fly?
Principally, I just wanted to fly, but I have to admit that my brother, who was a pilot during that period, I was young, probably 5 or 6 years old, four or five years old. He would bring home paraphernalia like parachute harness. We'd hang them in the tree and swing in them, that type of stuff. And he'd bring home smoke flares and that type of stuff. But mainly my desire to fly just came from watching airplanes fly over and wanting to do that.
Okay. What made you decide to go to Southern Illinois?
I can't answer that question.
Okay.
I guess I got a scholarship to go there, and that's the reason. It was closest.
Okay.
And it was a state school, and it was the cheapest. And since I was paying my own way through school, I went where the cheapest bucks were, and the closest, it was about a 2-hour drive from where I lived.
Mm-hmm. Is that a land grant school?
Yes, it is. It's a state school and land grant, and therefore they had to offer ROTC. That was, they had to do it.
Yes,
so it was required that I go the first 2 years. You're familiar with that.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So then you decided after that you definitely want to go Air Force instead.
Oh, absolutely. When I was in high school, I was asked to participate in a careers week, and I wanted to represent the guy who was going to talk about flying. Mm-hmm. When he came in, he was a civilian pilot, and all I wanted to know about was military stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and he had to not apologize and say, "I'm sorry, this is just civilian flying." I said, "Okay, that's close enough." So we went from there. But I knew from the beginning, you know, it's going to be there's going to be military flying. I guess one of the things that really struck me the most about military flying were the early movies. Mm-hmm. Where all the guys are flying in formation, you know, and they do this type of thing, peeling off to the side in their prop airplanes. That was very stimulating. And when I go out to an airport today and an airplane takes off, I have to look. It's still stimulating. The louder, the better. Okay. I saw you had some bumper stickers in there. We got one that says something like, "Jet noise, the sound of freedom." You know, those types of things.
Yes. What did you study in college?
I studied... I started out in engineering. I was going to get my money's worth if I was going to do it. I wasn't prepared for that. I got into industrial management in applied science. That was my degree, undergraduate degree. My advanced degree is management analysis.
When you got into the Air Force, if you would please describe your introduction into the Air Force, the training you received, the initial training.
Sure.
But was the focus on mostly Cold War aspects?
Of course, during that period, we were under the, you know, under the umbrella of threat from nuclear weapons. So that was that had a big effect on my life. I have to admit that a lot of my thinking dwelt around that one thing, that threat. But in the early stages, why, it was just a matter, I was commissioned at ROTC, and then I waited 6 months till they called me to active duty, and I drove to Laredo Air Force Base and just entered pilot training. And I was there a year, so it was just an intensive course, very intensive course, in learning how to fly jets. And after that, why, they sent me to survival school, Stead Air Force Base. Now, Stead Air Force Base was, survival school was based upon the experience that the POWs had in Korea, and they applied that to us very thoroughly, and it was a very challenging course. Mm-hmm. And it was practice bleeding. Does that mean anything to you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anytime we do something that that hurts or something, you know, that we think is that you actually kind of have to, you kind of have to bleed to show you're going to bleed. Well, then we call that practice bleeding. Well, they throw you in cells, and they play loud music, and they antagonize you, and they keep you awake, and they may get you wet and cold, and wear your resistance down, and make you go through interrogations, put bags over your head, and launch you around, so you're disoriented, that type of stuff. All the things that you would experience in a POW camp, we had to do, mm-hmm. without the pain or the actual conflict with the Vietnamese. But and then we had to do 3 days of field training, escape and evasion, where they give you a little bit of food and a piece of a parachute, and they send you out there for 3 days and say survive on your own.
Yes, sir.
So we did that, and that was a survival training, and it was very, very effective. And I will say right now that survival training prepared me quite well for the prison environment. Mm-hmm. There were no surprises. It was almost to the script, except it was more brutal, of course. You know,
yes,
but it followed the script very nicely.
How about the code of conduct? Did they cover that in this phase?
Absolutely. The code of conduct at that time was given to us, and that came out of the Korean War also. But the code of conduct was designed to prevent what happened in Korea, and I'll leave that as it is. But the idea of the code of conduct was that you will not give anything but name, rank, serial number, and date of birth unless you feel like you're going to lose your mind or your life, and then you can start lying or deceiving. You got to be careful of that type of thing, because an experienced interrogator can pick you apart on those eventually over time. Mm-hmm. But that was the code of conduct at that time. Under those conditions, you could lie, but you couldn't really go beyond lying, and that's where they left it.
Excuse me, Jen, did you have any questions concerning the SEER training that you received, the survival school training?
No, that covered it pretty well.
Okay. How about you, John?
You went through SEER training?
No, sir.
Oh, okay.
But that's part of my research.
Okay. Yeah. As an aside, I evaluated after I got back in 1978, 77 or 78, I evaluated the Navy school at Brunswick, mm-hmm. and then went to where the Air Force Headers now at Fairchild, Spokane, and evaluated those and compared them. Mm-hmm. And somewhere at home, I have a manuscript of, or at least a report that we did on that. Would you like to see it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Remind me of that if you don't hear from me.
Okay.
It's a pretty good.
Was there, in retrospect, was there anything that could have added or done differently in that early training, that POW training?
The main thing they could have prepared us for, that was the hardest thing in a prisoner of war camp, was that once you did break, then once you did start giving information, that you felt like you'd stabbed your country, your friends, and that were still flying, and your friends that may have been in the camp in the back. And that was the hardest thing to live with, was I wasn't prepared for that. You know, prepared to be a traitor or whatever it is, the John Wayne complex. And I use that term not offhand. The John Wayne complex was in us. And the John Wayne complex didn't exist as we thought it would. We weren't as tough as we thought we were. It took me a long time before I was able to get in rooms with other people to find out that basically everyone broke at some point and gave information. Well, that gave me a great relief. That made me feel like, you know, maybe I'm a real person after all. And I know who I am now, but it's not as bad as I thought it was. That was really a tough part, to grow up in the environment I grew up in, that the Americans don't talk, you know, and this kind of stuff. And die first and all that stuff. Well, pain's pretty stimulating, and it caused me to have great relief when I found out that I wasn't alone.
When did you finally learn that you weren't alone?
I was in solitary confinement for 30 days, and with no contact with the other prisoners. Mm-hmm. I tried, and that put me back in solitary confinement for a while. The first roommate I had, he was kind of like I was, but that's not representative. That just meant he was like I was. It probably took a half a year at least before I had enough information to know that it was that way. It probably wasn't universal, but it was universal among those who survived. If a guy didn't survive, you don't know if he held out or not, so we don't know that. But for those that did survive, the toughest to the weakest, it was universal to some degree.
But during your training, they did tell you, as students, that everybody has their breaking point, and eventually you probably did it?
I don't recall that. You know, that's a lot of years ago. It's back in the early 60s, like 1963. But the only thing I remember saying is that if you feel like you're going to lose your mind or your life, then start lying. And, you know, I started giving information. I did learn one thing from the Vietnamese, and that is that in the back of my mind, I almost committed suicide. I considered it, because what happened was, in the back of my mind, I always had this ace in the hole. Well, if I have to, I'll tell them the truth. But when I did tell them the truth, they didn't know the difference. It didn't mean anything to him. I was like, okay, King's X. Well, he didn't care. It didn't mean anything to him. Well, the mace and the hole's gone, and I had no escape after that. So I made a pact with myself. If it got so bad, I couldn't stand it. You know, the devices, the strap they used in the room was still there, and there was a bars in the cell that you could use. And they had strangled me unconscious many times, so being unconscious was an easy way out. So that wasn't any big deal, but fortunately, never came to that.
After you finished your survival escape and evasion training, where did you go?
After there, I went to Randolph Air Force Base in Texas, and then while I was there, I went to what we call PIT, Pilot Instructor Training, and that's where you learn how to be an instructor. And then following that, then I went to Moody Air Force Base, Georgia, where I was an instructor for 3 years.
While you were an instructor there, of course, the Vietnam War was
yes.
in full swing.
Right.
What did you hear about the war? While you were an instructor for 3 years, of course, there was time for other pilots to come back from Southeast Asia and become instructors themselves. Did you
That's
meet
true.
Any Vietnam veterans and
a few.
Did you talk about the war?
Yeah, a few. But again, I can only remember one person distinctly who had come back from the war, and I had one of my students who was flying 130s over there at the time, and I talked to him. Nobody really wanted to say much, and the instructor I talked to just wouldn't give any details. He wouldn't say much, which kind of disappointed me, because anytime you're going into a new position like that, you kind of like to have as much information as you get. And I felt that I don't know why he didn't want to talk about it, but he wasn't that close a friend. So I guess maybe he thought, go learn for yourself. Whatever. I can't say.
What was he training pilots on?
In a T-37.
You were training on the same?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what did you understand or think the United States was trying to accomplish in Southeast Asia at that time, before you actually went over?
Yeah, at the time I went over, the war protesting had, if it started, was very minimal. And the news media was very, I would say, positive about what was happening. They were saying about all these things that we did on a daily basis over there and what was happening. And it was positive. So I went over there, or at least I went through training, and that was a positive attitude. The biggest thing about the Vietnam War was it didn't seem to have any kind of a direction. Even I could see that. Where are we going with this, and how are we going to end it? What are we doing? Is it just punishment, or is it, are we going to try to eventually take over North Vietnam? What are we doing? And at the time, it just seemed to be retribution. But at my real concept of the war over there was that we were trying to make South Vietnam like South Korea. And by doing that, we would block off the north. But as we all know, that the way the geography set up, that wasn't very feasible, and it didn't work. But that is kind of the way I looked at it when I went over there.
What did you think when you got your orders that you were going to Vietnam?
Now, that's a good question, because I didn't have to go. I was coming up on my termination date for my first tour of duty, 5 years, and I could have put in my resignation at that time and gotten out, and the airlines were really hiring, and done that. But I didn't feel comfortable with that. Maybe it's a family history. So I decided that I would volunteer for certain airplanes that would give me a one-year commitment, and then after my 1 year was up in Vietnam, I'd come back and get out if I wanted to, make my decision with a clear mind, a clear conscience. So instead of the ones I volunteered for, I got the F-105, which gave me a 4-year commitment. and that made me mad, so I put in a non-voluntary statement, meaning they couldn't give me another assignment without me agreeing to do so. And then I got over to Vietnam, and I was flying, and they did away with non-voluntary statements, and that made me mad again.
What did you put in for that you didn't get?
I put in for the AT-37, which is just a fighter version of the, and it's different, but it's and the F-5, which is a T-38, the A-1 Sky Raider, and what else? I think that's it. I didn't want to fly bird dogs. No, that's too slow. But that's what I put in for, and they gave me the F-105.
Okay.
Next slot up, next name.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was it like transitioning into the 105?
Easy.
Yeah.
105 is the easiest airplane I've ever flown to fly. When I say it was easy, it took the normal process to learn how to fly a different piece of equipment. The flying aspects of flying is from one airplane to another is very similar. That size airplanes, size means a lot. But the 105 had a lot of equipment in it. And of course, you got all of your armaments and all your boards and stuff to select that. And the navigation system. The 105 was designed as a low-level nuclear weapons delivery airplane. It had an internal bomb bay and carried nukes. That's what it did. It set hot alert in Europe to go bomb Russia. at low level, and that's what it's designed for, but they just decided to hang iron bombs on it and let us dive bomb with them. But wasn't real suited for that, but it worked okay. It's a workhorse.
What kind of target acquisition training did you have, and what kind of range time did you have in terms of actually engaging?
Not enough. Yeah. The problem there was they trained us to be nuclear weapons delivery pilots, and we weren't going to do that. We did that, and we also did the dive bombing, shooting rockets and dropping bombs, and we also did air-to-air a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we did formation, and we did refueling and all that. All that was apropos, but the nuclear weapons delivery stuff, we could have used that on the range, because I definitely was not that proficient by the time I went over there. Mm-hmm. And by when I started flying combat, I hadn't flown in about 2.5 months, so first combat mission I flew was after not being in an airplane for 2.5 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead and describe the trip over from when you finally finished your training and were going over to Vietnam, to Southeast Asia.
Yes.
Where did you enter the country?
And I finished my training in like February. I took all the leave I had so I could spend time with my wife and kids, previous wife. And we went to back to Illinois, got to Illinois, and when the time came, I just went over by myself on commercial aircraft, and I flew to the Philippines. And in the Philippines, I went through jungle survival school, and that was neat. We went up in the mountains. It was not a starvation deal. We lived pretty good. We had a Negrito. Are you familiar with Negritos in the Philippines? I mean, guide with us, and he showed us how to cook manioc and how to get water out of the vines because we were going in a jungle environment. Mm-hmm. And that was nice. So we did that, and then before we left to go on our to Vietnam, we got my friend and I went through my class, got orders to go to Japan, and we were going to go through another training program for the wild weasels, not wild weasels, the Ryan's Raiders, where they put two pilots in an F-105, and you have to go in the back seat. Instead of flying the airplane, you're right in the back seat operating a radar and dropping bombs at night at low level with this thing. Didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. We sat there in Japan for a month and didn't fly. And then two pilots got shot down in the squadron, and they pulled us out of the program and sent us over to be strike pilots. So in a way, that saved us from getting into that program. You know, who knows which way it would have turned out the best, but here I sit. So I didn't arrive until May of 67 mm-hmm. to start flying.
Where did you arrive in country, in Vietnam?
Parat Air Base.
Okay.
Yeah, I went into Bangkok, and then Bangkok took a Looney Bird mm-hmm. to Parat.
What kind of briefings did you receive upon arriving there in terms of just introductory briefings, what life is going to be like, things to do, things not to do, anything?
I got briefed in by the Deputy Commander of Operations, and it wasn't significant because I don't remember it.
Okay.
I mean, he didn't put anything on me that hangs in my mind that you would normally think I'm taking a combat with you or what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. Before I left Japan, one of the pilots over there made a very profound statement. One of the 105 pilots that we would have trained with over there, he made a very profound statement. He said, when you get over there, you're going to find out that the pilots are lying about what they're doing. And I said, what? He says, yeah, they're lying about what they're doing. They're making up stuff about targets and what have you, and I couldn't believe it. So that kind of caught me off guard.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was profound because it was true. It wasn't so much the pilots; it was the debriefers, the intelligence people. And as an example, on my first mission, I flew with the squadron commander who was flying his 100th mission. So this was my first mission. I got out there and wallowed around and finally got the mission done. And we were flying in the lower part of North Vietnam, Package 1, just above the DMZ. And we found that it was terrible trying to find a target. But we we found something and we dropped our bombs on it. And he said he wanted to shoot the cannon one last time. We had a 20 millimeter walking cannon in the aircraft, and so he went down and he shot in some trees alongside the road. And I went back, and he went off for his 100 mission parade and his swimming pool trip and all that stuff in the Champagne. And I had to go debrief the intelligence people. Mm-hmm. And they said, what'd you do? And I told him what we did. And then he wanted to shoot the cannon one more time, so he shot into some trees and came home. He says, where is this truck parked? I don't know anything about truck parks. He just shot in trees. We don't shoot trees. We shoot truck parks. Where is this truck parked? So I said, okay. So somebody, this is the way it was going, and somebody figured out that we had destroyed more trucks than Russia built anyway. Normally the other side does that. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't like to think we do those types of things, but it happened.
And that was one example. I assume there are many others.
You want another example?
Sure.
They asked me if I would like to have my name, if they cared if I released my name with news releases. And I said, no, go ahead. So I'm reading these news releases, and I come back one day, and I'm reading this one. It says this flight of four F-105s went out in Package 1, North Vietnam, and they attacked a ammunition storage area, and huge explosions were billowing to 10,000 feet, and fires and stuff like this. And then afterwards, the flight went out and found trucks on the road and destroyed four trucks and came back. Mm-hmm. And man, that's great. I never seen anything like that. I read down, there's my name. I'm on the flight. Okay, what really happened? Four of us went out, and we couldn't get into North Vietnam because of the weather up around Hanoi, so we go down to Package 1, and there's a FAC down there flying, and he vectors us in, he shoots his rocket from a couple miles over, and he says, right about there. Mm-hmm. So we bombed this tree, and sure enough, we got a secondary explosion. It's a big puff of white smoke, mm-hmm. and it's much different than a bomb blast. So, hey, we did something. We did hit something down there. And then we went off, and we were road wrecking, and Lee says, I see something on the road, and he goes down, and he's starting to shoot, and he pulls off, and he says, no, come down. It's an ox cart. So that was it. We went back home. We did some more road wrecking, went back home, mm-hmm. and that's what it was written up. And how the intelligence people could, anybody could make a decision based upon the reports that were coming out of there is beyond me. Mm-hmm. But in fairness to the military, a lot of that was generated by McNamara and his desire to have numbers and, mm-hmm. and sorties and tonnages of bombs dropped and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So they had to feed this stuff up through the system. And unfortunately, we did. So that's the reason I say it was profound what he said.
Well, back at the base, you know, after you finish your day's work, sitting there at the bar having a beer and talking with the other pilots, this type of stuff discussed much?
Not much. It was too routine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a routine war. You want me to go into detail?
Sure.
Okay. We had two missions a day. There were 20 aircraft in a mission. Mm-hmm. Four of them were Weasels, and 16 were strike aircraft. And the Weasels, as you know, probably are out hunting the SAMs and keeping them off the strike force. Mm-hmm. And we fly up there like B-17s at 15 to 17,000 feet, all spread out in formations like this. We had ECM gear that patterned the area, mm-hmm. kept the guns off of us and the SAMs for the most part. And the safest way to do it. We flew the same route, same airspeed, same time every day. And except for different targets, you know, we basically flew the same routes. Now, I remember we flapped around Dien Bien Phu, Channel 97, you've heard of that. Near Dien Bien Phu, crossed 10 miles south of China, couldn't get in closer than 10 miles, hit the Thud Ridge, go down, and we'd go out whatever targets were at the end, back up the ridge and fly back. Tak Lee, the other base over there, they'd do the same thing at different time. Navy came in at different times. One of our biggest threats up there was mid-air collisions and dropped wing tanks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we go back and land at Krat, refuel. We for our mission, we get back and land. The afternoon, they'd refuel, rearm. Afternoon mission would brief, and they'd take off at 2 o'clock. And then they'd be back at 6 or 6:30 that night as it's getting dark. Did that every day, 7 days a week. Same time, same station. Same airspeed, same altitudes.
How many aircraft were lost before you yourself were shut down?
They were some lost. There was two or three, but they weren't when I was there. I was on R&R or something like that when they were lost. Actually, I was the first airplane that I saw get shot down. Yeah, well, it's in my 46 and a half missions. I get shot up all the time. The airplane's always full of bullet holes, but the airplane was a good airplane. It would absorb that. I took a 50 caliber down the intake one day, went through the engine. I didn't even know it. I rolled the airplane up, it was okay, and then the crew chief came looking for me. They had to jump the engine. I said, I felt this little buzz, but you know, it didn't feel like anything dramatic. It felt like the air turbine motor rather than the engine. But yeah, it was a good engine.
You took a 50 cal round through the engine?
Yes. Went through it. Well, you could throw ducts and stuff through this engine. It was huge. It was designed to do that.
Okay. What was morale like in the unit?
Good. We had people over there who wouldn't leave after their 100 missions. They wanted to stay on, and a lot of people volunteered to do another 100 missions. The thing that surprised me about that is all the time I was over there, I felt that I accomplished very little. When I came over there, remember the news media was saying all these things we were doing and all these trucks we were blowing up and all this? Well, I figured I'd get over there and I'd get involved in that, but I didn't see anything. Bridges were all down. All they had was rocks underneath the streams and the rivers. You could see the wake of the river going over, you know, the bubbles. Mm-hmm. So you could tell where they were, but the bridges were all down. The roads were dirt. You make big holes in the roads, and you come back the next day and they're filled up. Mm-hmm. And the railroad tracks were bombed down. The materials are right there. As soon as you leave, they put them back together. So it was just a harassment thing. And that's all I did. When they opened up the bridges in Hanoi, these were great targets. I mean, these were real targets. These bridges are, the Paul Doomer Bridge is 2 miles long. Hard to hit. Just a big metal structure. You can see that picture. And you had to hit it directly, you know, to do any good on it. But the Thai Wind Iron and Steel Works had been turned to rubble by the time I was over there. We bombed it every now and then because they thought they saw smoke coming out of some building that might be smeltering iron or something, so we'd do that. We bombed suspected troop barracks. I can't answer to what they might have been, and I don't know where they got their intelligence, but that's what we did. But mainly we just went out and harassed them. You know, we kept them busy building roads and bridges and railroads. The Tam Wa Bridge, you know, I don't think we ever knocked that thing down. I wasn't involved in that one, but we lost more airplanes there than any place else, any single target.
How about trail interdiction? Did you do any?
Yes, the trail interdiction, we did a lot of that. They called that Red Route when you got down into Package 1. It went into Laos through the Magia Gap, or whatever they called that. Mm-hmm. And then we went into there and flew over Laos quite a bit. And The DMZ looked like a big barbell because it had all been defoliated and had a big circle on one end and a stripe across and a big circle on the other, and hit Laos and very easy to see from the air, and it had been churned up, and the Ho Chi Minh Trail went around it, and you could see the Ho Chi Minh Trail for miles because it was dirt turned over it, and this road going through it, and you turn the dirt over again that night or that day, and they'd repair it and get the trucks going that night. But you can see these things for miles. I have home movies and stuff that I took and looked down there, just bomb craters and shell craters forever. Wow. We fly across the DMZ sometimes to go out over the Gulf of Tonkin, and then we refuel there and then go into North Vietnam over what we call Mig Ridge, which came in over near Haiphong at whatever that nice area is out there in the waterfall, the car sticking up. You may have taken that trip if you went out there. Did you do any sightseeing?
A little bit. Okay. You mentioned the use of electronic countermeasures in
yes.
terms of the SAM sites and things like that.
Yes.
What about MIGCAP? Did you guys have
We had our own designated MIGCAP for a while. The MIGs were very inactive when I was there. I saw a few. In fact, the day I got shot down, when I was coasting out, I got jumped by a MiG, and he fired on me. But he fired a I can't figure it out. He fired a pod of 2.75 rockets. You had one in your in your thing out there, you know, not the big round, not that long. And what he was doing carrying those are air to ground. I don't know why he's carrying them far, but he fired those at me, and they went over the canopy, and they were still burning. They only burn about two and a half seconds, and then they go out. They were still burning when they went by. He's right behind me. And then he came by, and on the left side, with his afterburner going, I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he was gone. And shortly thereafter, I had to bail out. But that was the closest I ever came to being shot down by a MiG. The MiGs did do some harassment actions over there, but for the most part, they didn't come up. We'd see them periodically. Now, sometimes we'd have F-4s flying MiG cover for us, especially if we were going downtown Hanoi. But they were hazardous because they dropped their wing tanks through our formations. And you see these wing tanks come down.
Were they doing it on purpose?
Oh yeah, they jettison. You know, they ran out of gas and there's too much drag. They can't keep up with the 105 very well, so they dropped their wing tanks so they could maintain their flight and not run out of gas.
But I mean, when they do it on purpose while they're over your formation?
No. They didn't try to hit us. No.
Okay. Well, I didn't think they tried to hit you, but
they weren't careful enough to. Yeah. You know, to position themselves in a better. It just looked like they were coming at us. If you could see them falling, you know, it worried you.
Yes, sir. That MiG that you did have that encounter with the night you were shot down, the day you were shot down, did you get a good look at the pilot?
Yes.
Could you tell his ethnicity?
Tell his what?
Ethnicity?
Oh, no. Yeah, pilots wear masks and got their helmet on and their visors down.
I didn't know if he had his visor up. You could see if he was the Vietnamese or perhaps.
No, I'd say probably 250, 300 feet away when he went by, which is close for an airplane.
Yeah.
And he screwed it up. He had an excellent opportunity. In fact, during interrogation, they tried to get me to admit that he'd shot me down, and I never would do it.
So it was probably a Vietnamese pilot.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and discuss, if you would, the events leading up to you being shot down. That day, the mission, what the mission was supposed to be, what happened.
Right. I'd been flying two sorties a day, which is very tough.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if I flew two missions that day or not, but it was an afternoon mission with a 2 o'clock takeoff. And we knew it was going to be tough. The Doomer Bridge had been bombed and dropped. And the Canal Rey de Repis Bridge was scheduled for Tokoli in the morning, and it was fogged in, they didn't get in. So we're flight up in the afternoon, so we're coming in the afternoon, and it's our target. So of course they're expecting us. And it didn't make any difference. You know, they're always expecting us. Their guns were all around Hanoi. So as we came down Thud Ridge, the SAMs were shooting. And I did see one SAM explode, but it was some distance away. The other thing was when we came down off at Thud Ridge, it was just a beautiful clear day. And I was probably in the second flight that went in. And when you drop your bombs, you could never see them detonate because we dropped them so high. If we got below 4,000 feet, they'd tear you apart with their automatic weapons. So we tried to pull out 4,500 feet. And we're diving down on the bridge, and I've never seen the amount of anti-aircraft fire that I saw. I've never been in Hanoi before. And the sky was just full of flak, you know, the exploding white puffs and stuff. So I'm flying on the wing of the leader, and the bridge is in my reticle sight, and all my instruments tell me it's time to drop. He hadn't dropped yet, so I went ahead and dropped on my own instruments and waited for him. He dropped a short time later, and as soon as he dropped, then I broke off and started jinking, just maneuvering your airplane. If you ever shot at a dove, you know, when you shoot at them, they jink. Okay, so I'm jinking around out there, and I turned back toward him, and that's when I got hit in level flight. All the flak was above us at that time. I'm in clear air because it's going through us.
Mm-hmm.
We had a saying for that. We called it the Golden BB. They could never hit me, but the Golden BB, I might run into it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Golden BB hit me on the nose cone of the aircraft and just exploded. When it did that, the airplane decelerated just very rapidly. I was thrown forward in the shoulder harness, you know, almost. I've arrested on an aircraft carrier one time, and it felt like that. Just tremendous deceleration.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm kind of in shock, and there's a big hole in the canopy, a lot of air noise. Mm-hmm. And I call out on the radio several times that I'd been hit. And they're talking to me, but I can't hear them because of the noise, the air noise. And I've got that on audio tape at home. My roommate was, we used to audio tape and video, not video, we didn't have videos, and movies and stuff. Would you like that too?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, you can hear it.
It's very, very hard to understand, but you can kind of hear it. But anyway, it gives a feel for the environment. So the airplane decelerated, and you know, I come out of it, and it's still flying, and so I'm heading off to the ridge and back to that ridge. And number three, the F-105 behind me comes by real close. He's looking me over, but he's going like mad. We had preconceived ideas up there that anybody gets hit, there's nothing anybody else can do. Don't hang around. You're going to have two airplanes shot down. Remember I told you the two people got shot down and I left Japan to go over there? One was the old squadron commander leaving. The other was the new squadron commander coming in. The old squadron commander leaving got shot down. New squadron commander coming in went back to see what he could do. And, of course, he gets shot down. So they got both of those. So it's not a good idea. And so these guys, you know, the flight goes on.
Yeah.
And away they go. And I'm coasting out best I can. You know, the airplane's still flying. And I'm trying to look around. I look down the left side of the airplane, and it's all full of holes. And, you know, the wing is really beat up. The air in the intake for the engine is all beat up on both sides. And as I'm looking down the left wing, that's where I see the mate coming in. And I think there's two of them, because the airplane's always flying two. Mm-hmm. One is just one. But I called him out on the radio. But he falls in behind me, and the F-105 is a very thick and big airplane, so I just kind of scrunched up in the seat. He can never get in and go through the airplane to get me. He can shoot the airplane now, but he can never hit me because it's so heavy. But you know the rest of the story. He missed and took off, and I concentrated on ejecting. And I pulled the ejection handles up and expected the canopy to go. It didn't. So I thought, well, I have to eject through the canopy. They'd made a mod that I'd forgotten about. So when I couldn't clear the next hill, I pulled the triggers, and the canopy went, and the seat went. And it was, they say it's slow motion. I didn't experience that. To me, it was just a tumbling, disorienting experience. I had no sensation of seeing anything except, you know, all these images going around because I was tumbling. Mm-hmm. And then the parachute opened with a crack. Again, it was very, very severe, much more severe than I thought it would be for the airspeed I was at. But it was so severe that I had baby bottles with in my flight suit with water in them, and it just ripped one right out of my pocket. And then I came to the end of the vertical position. I deployed my seat kit, and it went down to the end of the rope and hit the ground. And then I landed on the ground, so I didn't even get a chance to see the captain. That was my parachute ride, just a few seconds.
You weren't injured?
No, that's good. Just, you know, scratched up a bit, things like that, but no real injuries.
How long did it take for you to be captured by the villagers?
About 5 minutes. I was right next to a village.
How did they respond?
The I was on a hill, and it was a rolling hill, and it was an airplane crashed right by me. I felt the airplane impact when I was in the chute. Didn't see it, but I felt it. When I landed, I was facing it, and it was cooking off 20-millimeter shells. And I got out of my parachute and tried to call someone on the radio, but they were out of range. And I heard the Vietnamese, and I was up on this hill. It was a pasture, no trees, nothing. I saw a ditch that had some weeds in it, and I ran up there and jumped in the weeds, but they'd already seen me. So they just meandered up there, and so they all got in position around me. Then somebody knew enough English to tell me to stand up, and I was smart enough to do it. They had some rifles, and one guy had a wooden rifle, you know, play rifle. But they had some old World War I firearms that I don't know if they'd work or not, but they had them. So they came up and disarmed me, and I had to take my own clothes off because they didn't know how to work zippers. You know, G-suits and all that stuff, and they strip you down to your underwear. shoes, boots, and everything. And they're waving my pistol around and my knife, my survival knife, which is a nice knife. And that kind of worried me. That's when the guy grabbed me, you know, he grabbed me by the t-shirt, and he was going to do me harm. And the other guy says to him, no, don't hurt him, or the government will give us two bags of rice. I don't understand any Vietnamese, but I'm sure that's what he said. So the guy simmered down, you know, after a while, and let me go in disgust. And I think that's the guy that I met later on. So they didn't do any damage to me. They start marching me back toward their little village, and an F-4 recce bird comes over, and they made me get in the ditch they dug, like a combat trench. And darn the F-4 didn't get shot down by a SAM. And they're just, you know, having a ball, pointing up there, make sure I see it. And I look up there, and one big black plume of smoke, and the airplane's headed down. And as luck would have it, the pilot of that airplane became my roommate later on.
And was he tasked specifically to get some photo reconnaissance of your being shot down?
No, target. A bridge would bomb.
Okay,
yeah, he was there to get the. Yeah.
Okay, he was there to get the bomb damage assessment. Yes, the damage assessment. Yeah. What you did. Okay.
Yeah, and he got shot down by Sam.
Wow.
But it was a single ship. I didn't know a lot about Ricky at that time, but he's by himself. Yeah. Two-seater, naturally.
Then you got picked up by the helicopter. Shortly.
No, they came for me in the truck.
Oh, in the truck. I'm sorry.
Yes, and the villagers. These were mud huts. I think this was a temporary village when they evacuated Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was a temporary village, and mud huts all over the place. They put me in a mud hut, and they took me out, and they put me in a wooden building.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't much, but they sat me down and gave me a cup of tea, and then all the kids were peeking through the cracks and this type of stuff. And I just sat there for about 2 hours, and then the truck showed up. The Army took custody of me, and they put me in the back of the truck and blindfolded, and we started to turn down toward Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped at all the villages, and they had a bullhorn, and they'd have a pep rally.
Mm-hmm.
And the closer we got to Hanoi, the more vocal and more antagonized the crowds became. As you're flying combat and you're doing these things, you have a preconceived idea that you do not want to bail out where you just drop your bombs, because
mm-hmm.
they'll tear you apart,
mm-hmm.
and that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So you get as far away as you can. And the closer I got to going back to Hanoi, the more apparent that became. You know, people are throwing rocks now, and now the guards are protecting me. So we get to a point, and they splash some water on my feet, and so I'd know what it was, and then put it to my lips, you know, and give me a drink. Then they moved me to a Jeep, and then they had a guard on each side of me in the Jeep, and the guards were taking as many punches as I was. People were trying to get at me. So I was blindfolded, you know, I couldn't see, but I could feel the punches. And then they drove me from there to an airfield. And I think the airfield is probably where you flew into in Hanoi. What was the name of it? I don't know what they call it now.
It's the National Airport.
Yeah, that's where I'm pretty sure that's where they took me.
Mm-hmm.
They put me on an airplane, and I knew I was on an airplane. I could smell it, and climbed up in it, and then they took off, and I thought I was in an airplane. And it wasn't until I landed that and I don't know where I landed, but when I landed, then the wind blew my blindfold down, and it was a helicopter. I didn't know I was in a helicopter. It was that smooth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it didn't have the whoop-whoop, you know, all airplanes are kind of bumpy. So from there, they put me back in a Jeep and took me to Wallow prison camp to begin my ordeal.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and describe your first experience there, your first experiences.
Okay. Well, of course, the first thing that it means are after is military information, as much as they can get, as quick as they can get it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the last thing a grunt pilot knows is military information.
Mm-hmm.
So they take me in a room and they take my underwear away from me and give me some black pajamas, shorts, short sleeve shirt. And in retrospect, they gave me a short sleeve shirt, and at one point, one of the officers gave the guard heck because a short sleeve shirt, because they were going to use the straps, and the straps, you know, tear your skin off. But the initial thing they did was the interrogator came in, and I stood and tried to act military. They say try to show them respect, and may help. It was just a staring contest, and you know, I didn't want to be there. But started asking me questions, and I politely refused, and politely told them who I was and what I could tell them, and couldn't do any more. Geneva Convention. Well, we don't. This is not the Geneva Convention. You're not a prisoner of war. You're a criminal. You know, and this is the common theme that they had through all of our confinement, that they never really changed. It was, we were criminals the whole time we were there, even when we were released, and you know, from their perspective. So so he gets mad and he leaves, and then another guy comes in, and take that back. He gets mad and he leaves, and the guard ties my arms behind me with straps. He just straps them above the elbows behind me. And the during the interrogation, why the interrogator has asked me, and I still won't answer, but I'm starting to dance around my toes a little bit. And he's watching my hands, so I know he probably has limits. He's seeing how blue my hands are going to get before he lets circulation back. So that gives that kind of a clue, you know, that probably couldn't damage me too bad. And so he eventually releases my my hands, and you know, and that hurts just as bad for the blood to come back. Okay, and then they have me sit on a stool, and then they do the double hammer lock for a little while. And you can stand that. You know what I'm talking about?
I think so.
You're familiar with these. The double hammer lock, where they wrap the straps around, and then they just keep tightening it up until they force both your hands up behind your head. And that's pretty excruciating. But after a while, it gets numb. In other words, it's easier to tolerate the more time passes. The pain starts dulling. And then they had me sit on the floor, and then they have you sit on the floor Indian style with your legs crossed, and then they strap you down and pull your whole head down and tie it in a ball. Then they leave your room. That's the thing about it for a while. So they come back, and they've got to release you after a while to get the circulation back. So this goes on for about three times, and I can tolerate that, but as time progresses, they're starting to wear you down. Then later on, while they since it wasn't working, they strangled me with the strap. I'm still tied up back here, but I'm not tied around my ankles, and they just throw the strap around the throat and strangle you unconscious. And then you wake up and you set up, and you know, they do it again two or three times. That's pretty scary. Somewhere in there, and I say, okay, I'll start talking to you. And so I do. I start telling this and that, and get out of the straps for a while. And then they're not satisfied, so they do it again. This goes on all night, and they leave me alone in the morning. And I just lay down right there on that slab floor, you know, and go right to sleep. I was exhausted. And then they come in, you know, and start all over again. This went on for a week. And then they moved me out of the room. It's a knobby green room that's in there. And the thing about this is that it's wearing on you. You're strong as you think you are, but as it goes on and on and on, it becomes unbearable, and you just can't face it again, and you're not getting enough sleep, you don't have any food or water. And it's degrading, and that's what wears on people. We found out that the worst torture up there was sleep deprivation. In the long run, you can tolerate pain to some degree, but sleep deprivation is harder to tolerate for some reason. And some, you know, a record I think was 12 days on sleep deprivation, where guys were able to sit on a stool and not move. You know, they doze some, but get water thrown on that kind of stuff. But we had a record, I think it was 12 days. But we did this for about a week, and I gave them, like I said, more information than I wanted to. Some of it was accurate. And they finally moved me out into another area, and I saw an American with a little bamboo broom. He was outside my door. My door had louvers on it, and I could see his feet, and he was moving around. When he came by my door, I said, "Hey, I'm new here. What can you tell me?" And this guy was startled. He must have been mentally deranged, because he jumps down, looks up at louvers, and grunts, you know, looks back and forth to me, and a guard runs him off, you know, and I'm exposed.
Yeah.
So back to the knobby green room for another round, and then into solitary confinement in the what we call the Heartbreak Hotel, little cells there in Hanoi Hilton. So anyway, they let me in there for a month, and then put me in a room with one other guy. They had air raids. It's kind of interesting being on the receiving ends of air raids. The air raids there, you could hear the flak coming down out of the air, you know, from the air burst and things like that, and then concussions of the bombs and the airplane noises. When they had the first air raid, I thought they were doing a survival school trip on me. It sounded like somebody was out in the hallway beating on pots and pans, making a lot of racket. It just didn't sound like explosions because of the area I was confined in.
Yeah.
But that was my first air raid. Was I thought it was phony. And the guard came and made me get underneath that bunk. You saw that dirty bunk in that picture I showed you? And they wanted you to climb underneath there for safety.
Excuse me. Jenny, did you have some specific questions you wanted to ask before you leave?
Actually, I'm going to have to leave right now to get back to my class.
Okay. I'll be available to you through the email, and be glad to help you out any way I can.
Thank you.
Or Steve, or anybody else.
Okay.
You got other questions?
Thank you. It's very...
Well, would you go ahead and describe some of the other characteristics of the camp, as far as what it was like physically? What were you fed? Was it good water? Clean water, those types of issues.
Okay. The Wallo prison, which we called the Hanoi Hilton, was a prison that you're probably familiar with, was built by the French. And it had all the nice French implements in it. I'm talking about in these cells that were in, these two-man cells, at the bottom of the bunks, these concrete bunks were built in stocks for your ankles to go into. And when they used them, they would have us cross our legs to make it a lot more inconvenient. And the stocks were controlled on the outside of the doors. The doors had peepholes, all the windows were boarded up. There was a single light in the room that was turned on at night, and during the day it was dark. The guard could come by and peep at you through the peephole, and you just had to be silent. That was the only ones communicating. But it was very dirty, it was very masonry. I spent a lot of time looking at the walls, finding people's names who had been there before me, pilots, and memorizing them. You got nothing else to do, so you start looking, searching every crack. I remember sitting back on the one bunk one day, and I'm looking at this wall, and it hit me. The guy had written his name so big that it was out of perspective. Nobody would ever find it. You know, the Vietnamese wouldn't find it. The letters were that tall. His name is Crow, C-R-O-W. And there it was, C-R-O-W, scratched into the wall. So it was very foreign. What I mean by that is the smells and the noises and the sounds. The radio, they played the Vietnamese radio, and the music, it was just like out of being in the survival camp. They played noisy, antagonizing sounds that were foreign to your ear, just to throw you off balance. Well, they didn't do it on purpose, it was just there. I mean, it's music to their ears, it wasn't to ours. But the food was very monotonous. The water was boiled, which is the best thing they did for us. The water usually came to us hot, and it's summertime or wintertime, so it was boiled. Sometimes you could hardly drink it for a while. And we got a quart a day. And they gave us a little porcelain pot that we put it in. But at least it was safe to drink. And they gave us that all the time we were there, one quart a day. The food was, like I said, monotonous. Usually it was some sort of a soup. And most of the prisoners remember pumpkin soup, because you got water with pumpkin shreds in it and maybe a couple little pieces of pork fat floating around. And then on the side dish, more pumpkin, and maybe a little, but in a solid consistency with maybe pork fat in it. That was one seasonal vegetable they had. Another, what they had was, we called sewer greens, which were probably pretty good. It's some sort of fluted green that I'm sure had lots of vitamins, and like spinach. And we got that, and then we had potatoes were in season. They would they'd bring you potatoes, starting with marble-sized potatoes, and then as the growing season went on, they'd get bigger and bigger and bigger until finally they were rotten. And then they'd give them all to you at once at the end, which were kind of rotted. But they didn't have storage facilities over there. The rats were reigned supreme, so they kind of ate their produce as it was produced. Another one was some sort of a squash and cabbage and those types. But usually we had four different vegetables for whatever time of the year they were being grown. And the side dish was made out of the same thing. The meat allowance for us was negligible, a little bit of pork fat. The skin with these things look like the little candy kernels of corn.
Mm-hmm.
They're V-shaped and maybe a little bit of lean meat on the bottom, and then the fat layer, and then the skin with the hair sticking out. Also, most people think we ate rice. We did eat some rice, but the majority of the food we had, the grain products, was bread. And the bread was a French loaf-looking piece of bread. It didn't taste good. It tastes like spoiled or soured sawdust. And it has string and varmints and rocks and stuff in it. You have to be careful eating it. But I'm sure it was nourishing if you could get it down. It was tough to get down. I think they specifically let it age before they gave it to us. It probably was pretty good when it came out of the oven. Decent. But that's what we had, was a half a piece of bread like that. And that was pretty nourishing if you could eat it. Most of the food they gave us would sustain you. We all lost weight, but it would sustain you if you could eat it. Some of the stuff was really tough to eat. Do you want details?
How much? Well, sure.
Chicken feet? I mean, you want a chicken foot out of your or chicken head or guts, rocks. You have to be careful with the rocks.
Yeah.
And the dog. Sometimes we think meat is dog meat. Mm-hmm. I know they eat dogs on that. The hoofs, pieces of hoof, anything. They didn't throw anything away.
Yeah.
So whatever wasn't really good for anybody else, we kind of showed up in our soup. So you just had to eat it. There were insects and geckos and stuff around. If you felt like you were starving, I don't know if anybody ate them to keep them starving. But they were there, as a supplemental food source if you wanted them.
But you don't know of anybody that actually did eat
lizards? Not for their food value. I know people who ate one on a dare or something like that, or somebody found one drowned in his water bottle, before he saw it was in there. But I don't think anybody ate them for food value. The food was generally adequate.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, but I was there. By the time I was shot down, Alvarez had been there 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hayden Lockhart and Phil Butler and those guys that came later, they'd been there a long time. And there were periods of famine for them. Some of the people suffered from vitamin deficiencies. And I don't think, I ate everything they gave me. I'm a farm boy, I could eat dirt if I had to. But some of the guys just couldn't eat some of the food they brought. And we made allowances for taking care of those people that couldn't. We'd give them the better things that they could eat if it were possible, if we're in a room big enough to do that.
Mm-hmm. But you were initially in a room with only one other person?
Initially, yes.
How long did that last?
About a month.
And how much communication could you have between each other?
We were in the same room.
So you could talk?
Yes.
Okay.
Whisper. You couldn't make any noise that would carry outside the room.
Okay.
They were... When I was shot down in 1967, I didn't realize it, but I was shot down in right in the middle of the worst purge that the prison system had. They had just beat the crap out of all the prisoners that were there. Their communication process had been pretty well shut down. It was the worst situation. When I read this book, Return with Honor, I learned a lot from it. I found out, man, I thought it was that way all the time. And I just happened to step right into the boiling pot when I was shot down. So if I'd been shot down before or after, it may not have been as tough on me initially. But they would allow us to whisper. Mm-hmm. And then it was, I guess I was with him about a month, and they called us into, maybe it's 2 months, memory's fading, but they called us into an interrogation and with this Vietnamese officer, and then they brought in two more American prisoners. One guy was on crutches, and they had us all sitting there, and he was facing us. He was going to have to put us all in one room. This room is 5 foot by 7 foot, but it's got two bunks in it. Now they're going to put four of us in there inside. This is inside the Stardust, which is one of the inner camps of the Hanoi Hilton. Mm-hmm. So, but he's telling us that, and he uses all these cliches like the fat's in the fire, things are going from bad to worse, the Americans are running willy-nilly, and there's go got too many prisoners, we have to put you in all together, behave yourself. This is the effect of what he was saying. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just ecstatic, you know, I'm finally with a group. And but I can't show this, you know, when we sat there and listened, yeah, okay. So they put us all in this room, and we stayed in there. And it's not easy to live with somebody that close, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But this group is pretty good. So we were there about 4 months. And then they, excuse me?
Who were they?
They were Wally Newcomb, mm-hmm. and Dennis Chambers, and no, it wasn't Dennis Chambers either. It was Wally Newcomb, Charles Zuhowski, and Dave Carey, Navy guy. Two Navy guys. Wally was 105 pilot from Karat, and the other two guys were Navy guys. Mm-hmm. And we lived together for about 4 months, and then they moved us out of the Hanoi Hilton to the annex to the zoo, which we, whereas they mixed us up. We were five in a room in the annex, and the annex was the camp I stayed in the longest. I was there 3 years and didn't move more than 50 yards. Mm-hmm. And the rooms were bigger. The rooms were about this size.
Okay.
Maybe a little larger.
How many people were in there?
Five.
Five of them.
Yeah. It was, eventually we'd get up to seven in a room like that. And they had, it's an old French film library, and you probably heard of the zoo. Mm-hmm. It was right next to the zoo, across the fence, and we called it the annex to the zoo. And lived in these rooms for, like I said, in this camp for 3 years.
How much rotation would there be of people through your room? Or did it stay consistent?
That first room was probably about a year. And then I moved into another room and they mixed this up. And I was the only one they moved into the new room. And then we were in that room for about a year and a half. And then we had the great escape where the Atterbury, who was my roommate, he was the guy I saw get shot down. Mm-hmm. He was involved in the escape out of the annex, and he never came back alive. He and John Dermisi went over the wall, and they were picked up sometime later, and he didn't survive. And then after the escape, while they mixed us all up again, they put me in with the guys that had been there the longest, like Hayden Lockhart and Daryl Pyle and Phil Butler, these guys, and Hayden Lockhart was the second or third guy shot down, first Air Force guy. And so I'm living with these guys, been there a long time. Mm-hmm. So we stayed there in that room for a while, and then they, after the 3 years were up in 1970, I believe it was, they moved us to a place we called Camp Faith. And it was going to be, it was out near Sante, And Camp Faith was going to be a compound. Mm-hmm. They were gradually starting to let us out room by room more during the day. And it was Vietnamese or step by step. First nationality, they just, that's not right. Their approach to life is step by step. Nothing, mm-hmm. they don't make any quick decisions. They do one step, see how it's going to work out. And then they maybe take another step. So we were starting to get into this when they had the Santé raid. There was nobody in the Santé area, but we were probably 10 miles from that camp, in Camp Faith. And I think all the prisoners were basically there. Maybe not all of them, but most of them. I'd say there were probably 250 prisoners in Camp Faith in about four compounds. I didn't know at the time. Mm-hmm. I thought our compound was the only one that was there, but I found out later there were others. And there was about 55 in each compound.
And you're saying Faith.
F-A-I-T-H.
Okay. And you name the camp was named by the prisoners?
Yeah.
Okay. What did you hear, or when did you hear about Santé?
Well, we knew something happened when it happened.
Okay.
Because we saw the SAMs going off. We heard the aircraft, some aircraft noises. Mm-hmm. We heard explosions going on. And there hadn't been a raid in North Vietnam for years, ever since 1968, I think, and there hadn't been anything up that far. So we knew something was going on. We could see some flashes in the sky because our windows were basically barred, but we could see out of them. And the next day, there was no doubt about it. The guards show up in full combat gear with automatic weapons and everything on, you know, and their eyes are kind of big, and they put these little posts on the edge of the camps, and they had airplanes on them. They practiced aiming their rifles at them. The airplanes came down, helicopters went up, and they had sandbags, machine gun emplacements around the camp now. So we knew that something had happened like that. And then within 3 days, they had packed us all up and moved us back to the Hanoi Hilton and put all the prisoners that existed in the same camp at once. And we were able to get contact. They put all 55 of us in one room. It was a pretty good sized room. But when we lay down at night, it was 18 inches per person. And there's 55 of us in this room, but that was the best thing they did for us. Because now if you didn't like somebody, you could go down the other end of the room and talk to somebody else.
Hmm.
And we could organize. We had educational classes and entertainment and religious services, mm-hmm. and whatever you could think of. And the organization was there, and it was very, very pleasant during that period.
And how long did that last?
That lasted until... That lasted about 6 or 8 months. And then they started dispersing us again to the other camps.
When you were all brought together like that, did that include people like Admiral Stockdale and,
yes.
and Sam Johnson? And
right. Okay. They were all in the camp. Mm-hmm. But the high rankers were still, some of them were in solitary. Some of those guys stayed in solitary for 5 years. And yeah, Reisner was there, Flynn was there, Stockdale was there, Denton was there. Mm-hmm. And but they were in smaller cells by themselves, but we got contact with everybody. Mm-hmm. And we organized, and then we sorted out all of our names.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 500 some names, and we got them down to 352. And then memorized everybody's names in every room. And went from there. But a lot of the names had just come from, somebody'd say, have anybody heard about so-and-so? Heard of him, and that name would go on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his names weren't legitimate. Some of them didn't. Some of them just hear sweeping or coughing, and you get a name and you add it to your list, and it turns out not to be a real name. Mm-hmm. We sorted all that out then,
mm-hmm.
and took care of that.
How about the TAP code?
TAP code?
Yes, sir. Did you learn that?
Yes.
Was that?
I didn't practice it like some of the other guys. We had some real technicians
mm-hmm.
who could do that. Sound like a telegraph call. And they just do it with their fingernails on the floors or through the walls. And very good at it. I didn't do that. I did the mute code, which was the mute code was much faster. You could transmit information with the mute code quicker than you could write it down if you had something written on. And we usually take tile to tile, you know, and write it on the floor and then scrub it off later.
Well, could you describe that?
The mute code?
Yes, sir.
That's A, B, C, D, D, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z. And you shorten that, like, that's the, that's Vietnamese, and that's quiz, you know, shorten your words, a lot of them, especially the adjectives, or the adjectives in, what do you call it, normal words.
It's like sign language.
Yeah. But you had to be able to see somebody do that.
Yes, sir.
And you can transmit this, you know, hundreds of yards across the courtyard. If you can see somebody, and we managed to do that.
Would the guards not respond to seeing that, or they didn't care?
They couldn't see it.
Okay.
Like, the only person who could see it would be straight ahead, like looking through a peephole or something like that. And we stood guard for each other and did guard duty and during the communication processes. And, yeah, the communication system got working so well, it got burdensome with the amount of velocity and volume that came through. You'd never heard of the mute code?
No, I hadn't.
That was very helpful.
Yes, sir. Now, how many of the other prisoners learned that code?
Everybody learned it.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, getting the person to learn the code initially was the hardest part. And because you'd have to write it down. If you couldn't talk to them, you'd have to write it down on a piece of paper using toilet paper, what they give us, toilet paper and dust from the tile, and then you'd have to put the code on a piece of paper and then put it on the string that went up inside of the pants. And then when you went out, if you saw a new guy there, he'd always have these new clothes. You'd switch clothes with him and take his, and he'd take yours, and when he tied it, he'd pull it out and there'd be the note. That's risky, but that's the only way you could do it sometimes. One guy, we had a new guy in our camp one time, and the guard always came to our room first with bread. So what we'd do is we'd load up a loaf of bread, and we knew all the bread went in our camp. So we'd load up a loaf of bread, hoping that it'd be dropped off to him, trying to figure out where it was and all this. And, no, came to room 5, your note showed up in room 5, and okay, it went to room 1 this time, and you know, we never did get to the guy. Before they moved him out. But those are things that he tried to do. And if you could talk to somebody, you know, if you could ever get to them and say, hey, we've got a code here, tap code. This is how it works with the matrix of A through B dot K.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, that was a workhorse initially.
And eventually, I understand that even the classifications, the tap code, the different levels of tap code.
Oh, not that I know of.
Okay.
I'm not sure what you mean by that, but I don't remember any changes. There was different ways of doing it, like a hack, spit, cough, and sweeping. If they let some out to sweep, we could sweep the code, and nobody ever knew the difference. Did that a lot.
Sweep the code?
Yeah.
Wow.
If you're out sweeping, you had these brooms, you went, you can read it very easily. And if you're not familiar with the rhythm, you'd never detect it. Vietnamese didn't detect it, although they knew to communicate. We get caught all the time.
What would they do if you got caught?
They might put you in irons. They might whack you a couple times. Depends on what mood they were in or what the circumstances were. If things were tough and they caught you, it could be pretty bad. If it's just normal times, they might make you stand on or kneel on them. On the pavement, you know, on your knees for a couple of hours with your hands over your head. They might chain you to your bed. Some people got leg irons and what have you into the bed, handcuffs, all that kind of stuff. Whatever mood they were in.
Did you receive anything, packages or anything from the United States government from home?
Yeah. First of all, there are some of us that wrote letters and received some letters, a few. When I say wrote letters, we could write maybe, depending on how small you could write, I could get 100 words on this little note thing they gave us. And some of those got out. I've still got copies of them at home. The kids have the real ones. I kept copies. But, and I received a few letters from my first wife and got one from my parents. Now, the way they determined who received or wrote or not was if you had been released through their propaganda as a prisoner. When I was shot down, there was three of us captured in Hanoi that day, me and the two guys in the the F-4. Mm-hmm. I hadn't met them, but they released all of our pictures as having been captured American Yankee pirates.
Mm-hmm.
So my picture, my name had been released. So at least my family knew that, at least at that moment, I was alive. And so they gave me this letter after I'd been there about 3 years, first letter. And then later on, I was able to write. When they moved me into that group of old guys I was telling you about,
mm-hmm.
those were the ones who wrote letters. And so I was moved in with a group that wrote letters. And I had, I don't know if I'd written before then or not, but I started being able to write periodically. Well, we were after Sante, when we were all in the big rooms, just about everybody was writing letters then, once a month. Most of them I don't think got through, but some did. And packages came. Packages started coming in 1970. And the packages were pilfered badly. Maybe two-thirds were gone. But we were getting some things, and especially the vitamins were very, very useful.
Oh, yes.
Families were sending vitamins, right things.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably, the whole time I was there, which is 5 years, 6, 7 months, 2 days, a couple hours, a few minutes, I was, I had probably received maybe parts of five packages.
Okay.
And just before I was released, I got a Red Cross package. Within 2 weeks before it was released,
mm-hmm.
had books in it, and it was good.
Was that the first time you got your hands on books?
Yes, except some propaganda books they let us read.
Mm-hmm.
Like the one I just gave you,
mm-hmm.
that big one.
Mm-hmm.
Read that, that's Russian propaganda, and it was that type of stuff. With pictures, the captions are often well off the pictures. They don't really represent what the pictures really are, but they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And but I saw a lot of that.
Did you have any interactions with collaborators?
When we moved out of the big rooms in the Hanoi Hilton, mm-hmm. and they started dispersing us again after the Sante raid, they moved me into the zoo. And as soon as we walked into the zoo, we got in our room, but we were in a courtyard, we boosted one of the guys up on the wall to take a look around. And there was Milver and Wilbur standing there. And he says, I'm Bill Austin, you know. They said, well, I'm, whatever his first name is, Ed Miller. He says, okay, well, we just came in from Hanoi Hilton, you know, and how long have you been here? Well, we've been here all the time. Well, they had a room there, and their whatever niceties they had, which weren't that great. But then it wasn't 10 minutes later, the Vietnamese came back and said, do not climb on that wall and do not talk to anybody. He threw it on us. So that was the closest I came to having any contact with those guys. But when we communicated with the people over there in the zoo, when after we got in there, they told us that they treated Wilbur and Miller as if they were Vietnamese. And so we did too. But that's the only contact that I had with them. And that I never met them, never saw them. Oh yes, I did. Peeking through the crack in the wall or whatever, I could see them in the room. They had a fish tank in there with some fish in it. It was just, you know, it wasn't anything great. But and they wore shoes. They had clothes, and they would take them out in jeeps and stuff periodically. And we'd see them, you know, through the cracks doing this. I saw them a couple times. That's it.
What did you and the other prisoners think
of that?
They were
just collaborators. You know, just we figured they'd get theirs, you know, when the time came.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't think much more about it than that. Mm-hmm. As much as that was the 12 people who came back early, who took early release, those guys sold their souls. And they made, they all wrote out written statements to get themselves released. Why the Vietnamese didn't release Wilbur Miller is beyond me, except that maybe they were too effervescent. You know, there was even too much for the Vietnamese, probably. But anyway, these 12 guys that came back early, they all sold out and wrote confessions and did all this stuff that they asked them to do, and then made tapes to play to us. That's what drove us up the wall. They made these tapes, and they're going home tapes that we haven't listened to, and that made people angry. At least Wilbur and Miller were still sitting there in the same hellhole we were.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one guy that came back that he was ordered back. His name is Black, Art Black.
No.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Doug Hagel. Yeah, Black was not a good guy.
No.
Doug who?
Doug Hagel. Okay. He was a Navy seaman who fell overboard, and the Vietnamese fisherman picked him up. He didn't know what was going on. He just got picked up, and now he's a prisoner of war. He was ordered to go back if he got a chance by the senior ranking officer. And they'd offered it to him before, and he wouldn't take it. And so he took it, and he went back, and he had all the names memorized, and he blew the whistle on these guys that came back early.
Mm-hmm.
And that stopped it. The Vietnamese didn't release anybody after that. That was very helpful.
What year was that?
What year was...
The early release, yeah.
The last release?
The early release.
Oh, the early releases? That was... That started...
1968 was Black, and then
68, because they weren't there very long.
68 or early 69, because I knew John Black.
Yeah.
And the employment.
Yeah, I think 68 is when they started it, and I was in the annex, and we heard about it, and they released every 6 months or so. They released 12, so they stopped releasing these guys before the Santé raid.
Okay.
I really don't know when they stopped, but they started back in 68.
And they stopped as soon as?
As Hagel got released and he blew the whistle. We had one guy that came back, was on the Brigadier General list, and they found that real quick.
Yeah. This will end the interview with Mr. Thomas Norris on the 2nd of October, 2001.